is, I can always hide behind the pillar.
The Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Tuesday, April 14th, 2015 will come to order. Members, yesterday we had a hearing and the MPCA said they would provide us with a letter from the state of North Dakota. And so it's in your packet if you want to refer to the letter about that issue from yesterday. It appears that this is a half the river issue, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure there's anything in the letter that says that they're going to cooperate right away. But anyway, somebody else can read the letter and decide what it says. Today we're going to try and get through all these bills by 2 o'clock because I think Senator Bonhoff's committee is in here at 2. Is that correct, Senator Bonhoff? And so we'll try and get through all these bills before then. And I guess if we don't, we'd probably have to lay them over until tomorrow. Because I don't think we have an evening time for continuing. Right, we could go at 5:30? Tomorrow.
But
we don't have any extra time today if we don't get done. Okay, so if we don't get done today by 2, we'll have to adjourn and then we'll continue the agenda tomorrow. Okay, and yeah, exactly. So Senator Latz, welcome to the committee. We had this little private discussion, and I think this is your first time in front of this committee, but I'm not sure.
I don't have a recollection, so if I was here before, it was not a bad experience.
Okay, well, that's okay. That's good then. Okay, we have a quorum. So go ahead, Senator Latz, with Senate File 227.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 227 adds to the definition of collection agency debt buyers, individuals who purchase consumer debt and collect that debt on their own behalf. We're talking about collection agencies here, and debt which is no longer, in this case, no longer owned by the originator of the debt like the credit card company or the bank, but instead has been sold to another party, a debt buyer. Under current law, collection agencies that collect debt on behalf of others are regulated under federal and state statute. They are regulated because often they are using improper tactics to collect the debt. They've got the wrong debtor they're trying to collect it from. They've got the wrong amount that they're trying to collect. They're trying to collect old debt, meaning past the statute of limitations, and sometimes they're even threatening to bring a lawsuit to collect that debt when they have no legal basis for bringing that lawsuit. Or they're trying to collect debt that has already been paid to a prior debt collector. Because what happens is these debts are put together on disks and they get sent to the collector. Well, what happens often now is that debt is sold from the original bank, and it's bought by a debt buyer. And while these debt buyers are regulated on the federal level, there's no state statute that provides for regulation, which means that the State Department of Commerce and the Attorney General's Office have no authority to take regulatory or enforcement action against debt buyers, those who own the debt and are collecting it or attempting to collect it on their own behalf. Yet they are, in some cases, using the same inappropriate tactics when attempting to collect that debt. And often this debt is bought and sold and transferred multiple times. So you could have, and in fact there have been instances where the debt is sold to a third or fourth or fifth buyer while the second buyer is still trying to collect on that debt. So you could have a debtor, an individual like you or me, being called or contacted by multiple collection agencies trying to collect on that debt as well. So I don't know that we need to go any further into the reasons for the underlying regulation. This legislature has in past years, bills that I've carried, changed the statutes to prohibit certain practices and to make sure the Department of Commerce has authority to take regulatory and enforcement action against collection agencies that are collecting on behalf of third parties. Since some of those tactics and abuses are present among debt buyers who are collecting on behalf of their own debts that they've bought, then there's a gap in the statute in terms of enforcement ability, and this bill fills that gap. Because complaints relating to debt buyers are the largest category that the Department of Commerce receives complaints on that they do not have regulatory enforcement on, they anticipate that there will be some cost in terms of time for the Commerce Department to enforce this law. And these cases are complex. Sometimes they have to trace back the source of the debt to the original creditor. There is incomplete information frequently on these disks that have the debt information. So there's a lot of energy and resources required to enforce it. And that's why you have before you the fiscal note that projects that the Department of Commerce will need to add 3.25 FTEs to enforce the law. And that includes 5 cases they expect a year that will have to go through the Attorney General's office as appealed to the Office of Administrative Hearings. It includes 1 FTE to handle the licensing for what they anticipate will be 4,000 new licensed individuals who are collecting debt, and 2 full-time investigators to follow up when there are complaints about improper use of tactics, illegal tactics in the collection of that debt. With that stated, members, we do have available to answer questions. A representative from the Department of Commerce, Mr. Brickwood, is here. We have a representative from Legal Aid that is also present to answer questions. Ask for
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Support for and funding for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real quickly, Senator, so if the debt has been sold twice, obviously the debt is purchased, so all the creditors would be satisfied. So why would it? No, not necessarily. That was my question. Why would they still be trying to collect when they've sold that debt to somebody else?
Senator Watts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, what often happens in this industry is the buyer will buy the debt for 4 cents on the dollar, figuring that maybe they'll collect the equivalent of one, they'll get some small percentage of collections accomplished. They'll go for what they can. And when they feel they've exhausted their efforts on that particular group of debts, they'll sell it to the next person who's willing to take a crack at trying to collect on those debts. However, they may still take a run at some of it. They may still have the data, and they figure they might as well keep making some phone calls and seeing if they can collect on some of it, even after they've sold the debt to someone else to try to collect on it.
So just to follow, so there's no end of obligation then for that second debt person to say, okay, now I've sold it for 5 nickel on a dollar. I'm just free and clear of it. That was my choice.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, legally, yes, there would be an end to their obligation. Yeah. But that doesn't necessarily stop the person from trying to collect on the debt that they've already sold. And therein lies the need to have some regulatory enforcement.
Do you have any witnesses that want to testify, Senator Lacks?
Only to answer questions. I don't believe the department has any.
Does anybody
do you
need
want to add anything, Mr. Brick?
Anybody
no,
need
just
to testify
answer questions.
On this? Are there any other questions from the committee? Okay. Seeing none, then Senator Lacks will lay this over for inclusion in the amendment.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Bonoff, Senate File 138.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
members.
Bonoff, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for hearing Senate File 138. Senate File 138 is an equity crowdfunding proposal. I am here joined by Ryan Schildkraut. And Ryan and another gentleman, Zach Robbins, came to me last summer and they asked me if I would consider carrying this legislation. And they shared with me that right now, We do not have the ability for non-accredited investors, so people who do not meet income qualifications, to be able to invest in companies online. And that, in fact, is what equity crowdfunding would do. Crowdfunding is essentially the pooling of money by individuals to support a person, a cause, or a business. So investors would not receive financial compensation if the effort, they don't receive financial compensation if the effort is a success currently. So, for example, Senator Tomasoni, in our area, we've got the Comet Theater, which, as you probably know, Carol Carlson and Laura Bach knows, Carol Carlson owns. The Comet Theater needed to move from having old-fashioned 16-millimeter film to digital film by a certain date, or they were going to close.
Just for an FYI, I think that's the first time Laura Bach's name has been referenced in testimony.
Well, she should be referenced in testimony. So the Comet Theater needed to make this transition, and it was going to cost them $68,000 to do that, and they did not have the resources. So the Comet Theater did a Kickstarter campaign, and literally within a few weeks, they raised that money just like that. When that happened, I saw the power of using the Internet as a tool for accessing capital. But the problem is, in that case, people would invest in that particular thing, and they got nothing for it except a T-shirt. So this says that you could invest, but now you could be a shareholder. And so the bill actually does that. This bill would allow equity crowdfunding for non-accredited investors. We would be adopting an intrastate exemption. So this would be for people within the state of Minnesota to participate in this effort. We would allow emerging companies to raise capital by selling securities online to non-accredited investors. We first heard this bill in the Commerce Committee early in session, and the Commerce Committee came to the table and had many concerns with regard to protecting the investors and making sure that we were regulated in a way that would limit fraud. And so a group of people, including Ryan, who's sitting with me, and our own staff, and Brandon Peterson, who's got a similar bill, we met with the Department of Commerce week after week, and I see John Burns is here, and he joined us in those meetings. We met week after week to work out all of the concerns that the Commerce Department had, and that is the engrossed version that you see before you. There is a fiscal note because it directs the Department of Commerce to do rulemaking, and also allows for a third of an FTE to be able to provide the kind of oversight that would make sure that people and companies and the state was protected. So, Mr. Chair, I could either allow my testifier to just say a couple things, and if you'd like me to, I can take you through the bill subdivision by subdivision, but if you'd rather leave it to the testifier and questions, whichever you prefer.
Do you have to do it subdivision by subdivision? Can you just kind of give me an overview of what the bill does so you're clear?
I think I did that. But let me turn over to my testifier, and he'll do that.
Thank you, Chair Tomasoni, members of the committee. As Senator Bono said, my name is Ryan Schildkraut. I am a shareholder at the law firm of Winthrop & Weiss down in Minneapolis. I'm not part of our legislative group. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm a business attorney. I've been doing this pro bono. So I have no benefactor or sponsor or horse in this game other than the small business clients that I work with every day.
Nobody does anything pro bono around here.
This truly is. I've been working for years and years with small companies, and I have firsthand knowledge that the biggest challenge they face is how to access the capital they need to fulfill their business plans. The problem has been particularly intensified since the credit crisis started in 07 and 08. Came to my attention that other states, including our neighbors in Wisconsin and otherwhere in the Midwest, in Indiana and Michigan, in addition to about 15 other states throughout the country, had passed similar laws. And my colleague Zach and I decided, well, let's take it upon ourselves to try to get a law change here that would make it easier for our small business clients to raise money. So I'm happy to walk you through the bill or answer any questions.
Why don't you give us your version of what the bill does? Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So what the bill does, you know, we talk about it as crowdfunding, but the word crowdfunding isn't anywhere in the bill. Crowdfunding is really just kind of the fancy buzzword for allowing people to use the internet to connect with each other, to raise money for a company. So right now, if you are a company who wants to raise capital, the laws say unless you want to go through a very expensive and time-consuming registration process, which is not appropriate for a small company, it's for a big publicly traded company, then you are allowed to talk to friends and family, and beyond that, you can't advertise your need to capital to anyone. And when I say advertise, I don't mean run an ad and say invest in this, you're going to make a lot of money. I simply mean announce the fact that you're raising money. So you can't go on Facebook, you can't go on Twitter, you can't throw events, you can't be mentioned in a newspaper article. It has to be done completely secretly. So what this law does from a very fundamental level is allows these small companies to use the internet to connect with investors and ordinary Minnesotans who might want to be investors. So it's kind of modernizing our current laws to allow people to leverage the power of the internet to connect with each other.
So, Senator Bonner, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, so this bill sets forward a framework for issuers, those who are looking to raise capital, to be able to operate within a portal framework. So they could either be the portal operator themselves, or they could use a third-party portal provider, whereby they would be required to do the same kind of business prospectus that you would do if you were going out and doing a regular private placement. They would have to include their business plan, all the reps and warranties. All that is within the bill. It sets forward that the issuer must do that. In addition, it sets forward limits that if an issuer wants to raise $1 million, they can be non-audited, but if they want to raise $2 million, which is the limit that they can raise within the confines of this bill, they would need to have it seen and either audited or what was the
reviewed.
In addition, it provides a framework for if you're a non-accredited investor, there's a limit. You can only invest up to $10,000 in a company to make sure that there is some parameters and some regulation. It then Senator Pratt made sure, because he works in fraud prevention for U.S. banks, so he made sure we added language within this bill that has those issuers that be run against a database to make sure they're who they say they are, that they're not on some list of potential terrorists. It has to be a Minnesota company, because we're doing this law is a intrastate exemption. The SEC was told to create interstate rules for how this could happen around the country. They dragged their feet for 2 years. They've now put forward interstate rules for bigger kinds of offerings, but the type of offering where it's this limit of $2 million and $10,000, we're doing just inside Minnesota. And so that is why we have those limits.
So how do you know the people that are investing are just inside of Minnesota?
They have to register with the Department of Commerce, and that's why the Department of Commerce, in their fiscal note, they've asked for two things. One, rulemaking is expensive, but the rulemaking to be able to make sure they've got a very tight regulatory framework for this to take place in, and that will happen within the rulemaking framework, as well as the one-third FTE to make sure they've got oversight of people are who they say they are. But, you know, this is true in any kind of investment. We think that our rules are actually tighter with regard to this than exist outside of this marketplace.
Okay. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to state that I'm certainly in favor of this legislation. When I was elected to this body, one of the duties that I had to resign from was chairing our local redevelopment committee in Laverne. And so that I didn't run into any conflicts of interest, and also in the interest of time, primarily.
You didn't have to resign. But anyway, go ahead.
No, well, in the interest of in the interest of time, I did.
According to this committee, anyway.
But one of the elements that we did was as a local, in the local redevelopment, is identifying some of the needs that we have as a community in terms of businesses needed, et cetera. And there were, there have been three different entities that, quite frankly, have started up as a result of local investment. However, the same rules apply in terms of having to be, you know, at a certain level to be an accredited investor. And actually, sometimes these projects got put together, and other people said, "Well, gee, why wasn't I asked, or what have you?" Well, the rules really don't allow you to be out there advertising the fact and what have you. And so there's a very real local implication for legislation like this. And I certainly hope that you stay strong at the 10,000 level. I don't think it needs to be reduced to the 5,000 level. And I think this is a good opportunity for many of our communities and for the people in our communities to actually have a role in the redevelopment of their community.
And Mr. Chair, in your packet, there's a letter of support from the Minnesota High Tech Association, St. Paul Area Chamber, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Life Science Alley, ACG, Social Enterprise Alliance. A lot of the startups in today's economy, things like we hear from the breweries, we hear from people who are interested in real estate. They are having trouble accessing capital, and so they've kind of clamored around this approach and are very excited about its potential.
So, Senator Bonoff, you've gone through the Commerce Committee, and they vetted the language there?
Yes, and Judiciary.
And Judiciary. And are the departments comfortable with the language?
Peter Brickwoody is here, if you would want to make any comments.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwoody from the Commerce Department. Thank you for the question. We've been working with Senator Bonoff, as she outlined, over the course of the session, and with Ryan and many others in the room. The language has made great progress. We have, I think, one outstanding remaining issue with the Senate language, but for the purposes of this committee, it has no impact on the fiscal note. So very comfortable with the bill proceeding at this point while we continue the conversations on that one remaining point.
Tell us how you came up with $200 fees and $300 fees for portal operators and MinVest offerings.
Mr. Chairman, those are the fees outlined in the language of the bill.
And how did we establish those then?
I can answer that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, in the current securities laws, there's a method for companies to do what's called a SCORE offering, which is a registered offering for $1 million or less. And the $300 is the fee for that type of offering. And we just kind of thought that since this was similar and a similar type of filing and a similar amount of review, it would be a comparable amount.
And the 200?
I don't recall exactly, but the 2 and 300 are based on existing fees to make other filings, securities-related filings with the Department of Commerce. So they're in line with other fees for other activities and other filings.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, $162,000 for rulemaking. Can you explain that to the committee? What, without going in real in depth, but why the cost is so high?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, it's $130,000 for the rulemaking, and the other $30,000 is for the 0.3 FTE, as Senator Bonoff indicated, and that is the standard calculation as made, I think, by the Department of Administration that departments use for medium-sized rulemaking tasks, which this one is judged to be. There's a standard cost that all agencies are required to use in fiscal notes for a small, a medium, and a large rulemaking process, and this being deemed a medium-sized one, that's what we're using.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And how long does that take, that rule? For the agencies,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, we would anticipate completing that within fiscal year 16.
Okay. All right. So any other comments or questions? Any comments from anybody in the audience that would like to comment on this? So, Senator Bonoff, do you want this to stay here, or do you want it to go on its own?
Mr. Chair, I think it has the best chance of passing if it stays here, but if you think
I don't think so. You just tell me what you want to do.
Mr. Chair, if you'd consider putting it in your omnibus bill, I would request that you lay it over.
All right, then. Are there any other comments or questions on Senate File 138? Seeing none, then we'll lay over Senate File 138 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonner. Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1516. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Chair, do you think we'll be there a long time tonight?
It'll be a short one. Oh, we got sure. Legacy, 30 bill legacy.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Thank you for hearing Senate File 1516. It's a product, broad-based coalition of stakeholders that have worked over the past several months to put forth a proposal that works on the success of incentivizing compressed natural gas infrastructure and conversions across the country. Mr. Chair, there should be an amendment in front of you regarding a technical change, and John Williams from CenterPoint Energy is here, as well as John Hunter from the American Lung Association. But if members could see that amendment in front of you on the
Chair, I would move the A3 amendment, unless you want them to discuss it further.
No, we want to discuss it. Go ahead. Just because this is not the first stop, so this is not an author's amendment. So, Senator Hoffman, go ahead. And you can either have somebody explain it or you explain it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. It was inadvertently taken out, but Mr. Williams will hear to kind of go deeper in the weeds for you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is John Williams. I'm the manager of commercial industrial accounts with CenterPoint Energy. And yeah, this just accidentally was removed when the home fueling stations was removed. The purpose of adding a privately owned fleet service is to ensure that any fueling infrastructure that a private company would build, that would be eligible to the rebate.
Can I have a little bit more information on inadvertently removed?
Go ahead. Mr. Chair and members, when we took out the home, the last stop, the amendment, we took out the home fueling stations, and then privately owned fleet service should have stayed in there, but that was taken out at the same time, so we're putting privately fleet.
So it was an accidental deletion?
Accidental deletion.
Was it a oral amendment? Is that what happened? Or
Mr. Chair and members, no, it was an amendment that was not an oral amendment. It was a written amendment, but that was taken out. I don't know how it was taken out, but that's where we're at.
So is everybody comfortable with this, Senator Westrum?
Well, Mr. Chair, just a bit of a follow-up on that. You say inadvertent and you took out the home fueling stations. I realize that's not in the bill, but can you just explain to us why you took them out and now you're wanting to put these back in or intended to always keep these in?
Who wants it?
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Williams, otherwise I can get Murph up here, because that's where we really talked on it, was
Mr. Williams.
Was after the last stop.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator. Yeah, it was, again, like, just to help understand, the intent was to take the home fueling out, but not to take any private business fueling stations out. Does that answer the question?
A little bit. What is, when you say refer to home fueling, what are you referring to that was taken out
Mr.
at the
Chair,
same time this was taken out?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the in the original bill included home fueling. So, for instance, any residential home owner could put in a private home fueling station.
Oh, I see.
And so the request was to take the home fueling out of this bill, and again, just by mistake.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, Peter from the Commerce Department is going to answer this question for us.
Mr. Chairman, again, Peter Brickwoody from the Commerce Department, and Senator Westrum, I'm switching gears, taking my securities hat off and putting on my weights and measures hat. The Division of Weights and Measures.
What's different, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum. The Weights and Measures Division, as you know, has responsibility for inspecting fuel meters, commercial fuel meters across the state, both at commercial fueling stations and also for fleet services. There was some concern on our part with the language about home fueling stations, that we may need to have weights and measures inspectors going into people's garages. There are also, I think, on our part, some safety concerns related to that. And so that seemed perhaps just a step too far for the purposes of this bill for the fueling stations there. So I can let others speak to it. But just from the department's perspective, we were supportive of the home fueling stations coming out in the amendment in the previous committee.
And not this, Mr. Chair. Peter.
We're buying it that it came out.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Perfect. Okay, so on the Sparks and motion on the A3 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion adopted. Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is about providing a rebates to incentivize the conversion of the light duty, medium duty, and heavy duty motor vehicles to the compressed natural gas at the following levels, and those should be in front of you. The bill asks to also seek the incentivizing and construction installation of the commercial gas fueling stations, as well as those that rebates on the following that are in front of you as well. And with that, it passed our first round, and now with me today I have John Williams and also John Hunter here, and then Troy Sandvig in CNG Innovations and Tony Kellen from Wendell are here if you need to go and answer any tech questions. But Mr. Chair, I want to turn this over to John Williams and John Hunter.
Go ahead, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. We appreciate the opportunity to testify before you here today, and we appreciate that you're hearing this bill. And we also appreciate Senator Hoffman's leadership on this bill, and also appreciate that Senators Dibble, Herr, and Ingebrigtsen had also co-authored this. Our bill was prepared and supported by a coalition of companies such as CenterPoint Energy, CNG Innovations of Minnesota, Quick Trip, McNeilis Companies, Integris, Merck, Trillium, Wendell Companies, Excel Energy, and Zero Res. In addition, there was an NGV coalition in the last couple of years that was sponsored by the American Lung Association based on a DOE grant that they had received. Real quickly, on slide number 2, and I'm going to make this real quick, the kind of a current overview of the Minnesota NGVs, there's currently 300 to 400 NGVs that are either dedicated or bi-fuel vehicles. There's 13 public fast fill stations, and there's 12 private slow fill stations. Moving on, as far as reasons NGV and fueling station rebate program is needed in Minnesota, the first reason is to take advantage of the several benefits that natural gas provides, and that is it's domestic, it's abundant, it's clean, it's economical, it's reliable, and it's safe. In addition, natural gas also offers price stability and less volatility that other vehicle fuels don't provide. And NGVs, which John Hunter will talk about in more detail, but they really help meet state environmental and emissions initiatives, especially when it comes to non-attainment. And like I said, John will talk about that. Really, the primary reason for the bill, as well, is to help buy down the incremental cost of NGVs. Just real quickly, if there's three major classes of vehicles, light duty, medium duty, heavy duty. The light duty, there's an incremental cost of $9,000 to $12,000 per vehicle for the natural gas vehicle. For medium, it's $15,000 to $30,000, and for heavy duty, it's $40,000 to $70,000. And then what we're seeing nationally across the country is that many of the companies that are deploying NGVs, they're deploying these in states that offer incentives or rebates like this. And also what this should do is it should help any of the fleets that are kind of on the sidelines, it should help them to make the plunge into natural gas vehicles. The first slide of pictures that I have is light duty. And again, I just want to show just so people know what they're like. The next slide is...
Hold it, stop right there. So that...
Yes.
That pickup in the lower left-hand corner looks like it has the tanks in the box.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And is that where they all are, or is that just the conversion vehicle?
A lot of the tanks are in the box in this type of vehicle. And for any details, I could have...
But they have a gasoline alternative, or are they also all natural gas?
Mr. Chair, this one, yeah, these are bi-fuel vehicles that you're seeing here.
Okay.
So they operate, what that means is they operate either on gasoline or natural gas.
Right. Are there any of them on just natural gas?
There is dedicated natural gas vehicles, yes. An example would be the Honda Civic.
Okay, and is this bill targeted at what? At just converting vehicles that are using that are using gasoline now?
It would be at gasoline and diesel, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I stepped out of the room here, but the conversion cost for just a light duty pickup versus a heavy duty. What kind of costs are we talking about? The conversion kits, and you and I think you came into my office and we talked about it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator. Yes, for a light duty, so like on a pickup, it's $9,000 to $12,000 per vehicle. So it's in that range. If you go like to a passenger vehicle like a Honda Civic, it's like $6,000 or $7,000. But now if you go to medium duty, it's $15,000 to $30,000. If you go to heavy duty, it's $40,000 to $70,000. And most of the heavy duty vehicles are going to be dedicated, so they run only on CNG.
Go ahead and continue. Are you done, or are you going to continue?
Yeah, I'm going to quickly continue.
Okay.
So, right. Moving to slide 6, the heavy duty, and those weigh 26,000 pounds or more for the gross vehicle weight rating. You see on the right, class 7 is the refuse, and then you see the bus below, and then on the class 8 is the semi and the semstone or the garbage. Excuse me, the cement truck. So, that's just a couple examples. Moving on to the vehicle rebates, and all I'm going to say real quickly is, again, the three classes, light duty, medium duty, heavy duty, they all are at 50% of the incremental cost, and the cap for light duty is $5,000, $8,000 for medium duty, and $20,000 for heavy duty, and the total vehicle rebate appropriation for the vehicles is $2 million. Moving on to the fueling station rebate, slide number 8. For any government or privately owned or retail fueling stations, again, it's 50% of the cost with a $200,000 cap. We think that that'll generate about 10 stations, and the total appropriation for that is $2 million. Moving on to the projected rebate program impact on slide number 9, total program cost is $5 million. We feel that we'll get approximately an incremental or increase of 330 vehicles, so that's about 80 to 100%. Increase. Projected increase in government private retail stations would be 10, so that'd be a 40% increase over the 25 total we have now. And in summary, what this program will do is it'll really jumpstart the NGV market in Minnesota. And as I mentioned before, this market is already taking off in other states. And down the road, we don't feel that the market is going to need incentives, but anywhere from the next 2 to 3 to 5 years, it'll probably be helpful. So I respectfully request that you support this bill. Thank you, and I can answer questions now or after John.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, you have another testifier.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. John, the American Lung Association is here as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm John Hunter with the American Lung Association Minnesota. I just want to take about 1 minute to say why we support this bill and Senator Marty's electric vehicle bill coming up later to talk about the sort of air quality and health impacts. There is a little four-page handout in your packets, I believe, that I just want to, I think I'll let it do most of the talking. I just want to highlight real quick kind of why the four pages are sort of relevant. And the fact that the air quality in Minnesota is not as healthy as it needs to be, that is having both impacts on our health as well as our economy, both now and may develop into more severe impacts in the near future. Tailpipes are the largest source of air emissions in Minnesota. When you combine the on-road and off-road, we get close to 50% of the air pollution that's generated in Minnesota. So consequently, alternative fuel efforts like this are important at reducing our air pollutants. The two middle pages in that packet are from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's air emissions report. They get into a little more detail of where the air, different types of air emissions are coming from in Minnesota, as well as some of the potential health impacts that come from them. Broadly speaking, nitrogen oxides, known as NOx, particulate matter, and VOCs are kind of the big ones that relate to our ozone and particulate issues. And you can... You can see it comes from a broad range of different vehicle types and some other sources as well. But natural gas vehicles, as well as electric vehicles, can significantly reduce a number of these pollutants and help benefit our air quality. Page 3 kind of talks about the economic impacts that we're currently seeing from the air pollution levels that we have in Minnesota right now. We're talking thousands of hospital visits, hundreds of thousands of lost school days or lost days of work, leading to reduced productivity and decreased education, as well as up to 3,800 or so premature deaths associated with some of the cardiovascular disease or other respiratory issues that come with our air pollution. On top of this, the very last slide just kind of highlights that we're very close to being declared in non-attainment under the Federal Clean Air Act. The EPA is currently updating the standard for ozone under the Clean Air Act. Their final level is due out October 1st. They are proposed a range of 65 to 70 parts per billion. Right now, over the last 3 years, we would be considered an average of 67 parts per billion in the Twin Cities. So that if we do not reduce our emissions and we stay roughly the same, we would be, I think, declared non-attainment in a few years. Similarly, Marshall and Rochester are kind of right on the edge as well, so they're just a couple of warm summers away from also being declared a non-attainment. And in addition to the health impacts, it's also there are secondary levels that affect crop growth and other issues that might also be of issue in greater Minnesota. But for that, I guess I should also add the estimated cost of getting back into attainment, if we should go into non-attainment, is in the neighborhood of $200 million a year. That would mostly fall onto private businesses and the residents of Minnesota. So I would be happy to go into any other further detail if people would like, but I just wanted to be quick.
Maybe this is a question for Mr. Williams. How many fueling stations do we have in Minnesota now?
Mr. Chair, right now there's 25, but that's a combination of public fast fill and slow fill.
Those slow fills are really slow, too, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty much overnight, Mr. Chair.
Who designed those? Anyway.
Mr. Chair, they do work for the application that they're billed for, like refuse companies.
Okay. Senator Westrum, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, a similar question. I understand there is a slow fill, the fast fill. How fast can that go? And I think you said there's only like 12 or 13 in the state. Is that practical that you pull in like you do now and 10 minutes you're filled and you're on your way? What kind of time is a customer with a vehicle looking at in a fast fill application?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, yes, very good question. It's very comparable. It's most of the CNG, it'll pump out at like 8 to 10 gallons per minute, which is very similar to what you get on gasoline or diesel.
And Mr. Chair, a few questions on this line. So are we rebating fast fill stations or applications, and then are they geographically going to be set? You probably follow me. You don't want five new applications in St. Paul and then none in St. Cloud or Minneapolis or other places up and down the freeway, for example. How are we going to have the department try to geographically distribute these so it makes sense for the commuters to be able to have a place rather than have them all concentrated in one area?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, yeah, that's a great question. We have limits set by business per year and by vehicle class per year, and the reason that we put that in there was to try to accomplish exactly what your question is getting at, so that it would be statewide and it would be for different businesses, different governmental units, you know, or whatever.
But Mr. Chair, Mr. Williams, and Senator Hoffman, maybe we should look at this a little closer with some language for the department to look at geographic distribution as part of their evaluation. But I read what you're saying. One business per year, let's just use Holiday, for example. If they picked to put one of these in, and then Quick Trip, for example, another company you said is supporting this, and they both happen to have stations in a certain community, it seems like if we're offering this kind of a sizable rebate, we wouldn't want those two companies albeit they're different, putting one in the same proximity. You follow me?
Mr. Williams?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. West, or Senator Westrom. Yes, that's a very good question, a very good suggestion. And to make this work, and this is what you're getting at, I believe, mm-hmm. is that you basically need to have kind of a hub and spoke system so that people can get from, let's say, Duluth to Rochester or Duluth to Laverne or wherever, and that they can run entirely on natural gas. So your point is very well taken, Senator.
And so, Mr. Chair, on this bill, so I would think that might be something we should add in as geographic descriptions or proximities as part of the department. But are we rebating for both slow fill and fast fill? Are they all going to be slow fill, all going to be fast fill? Because my understanding is a slow fill is more like, you say, a refuse company. Companies that have their trucks out by day, they bring them in at night, they can hook them up to a slow fill. And coupled with that question, is slow fill cheaper, or why wouldn't we do fast fill everywhere?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, yeah, slow fill is cheaper. And it can range at different amounts, but the fast fill is going to be, if you're going to put it like 8 to 10 gallons a minute, like we mentioned earlier, it's going to be $1.5 million to $2 million for a fast fill station.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thanks for the liberty here, but one other question on the funding, and so it's a bit of a chicken and egg here. With E85 pumps and blender pumps and other things, it's always that scenario. You got to build it before people will buy enough cars to be interested in it, or light duty or heavy duty trucks.
Yes,
you got to have the heavy duty trucks out there in order to have enough demand to build the stations. I understand the chicken and the egg scenario here. This money is coming from the general fund. Is any of it coming from, or do gas companies get credit under conservation fund for maybe being innovative and putting these in to help incentivize the companies to work, or maybe to rebate some of this? Because under the conservation improvement programs, companies can offer rebates for more efficient ways to do things. Has that been thought of as a funding source or an incentive for the companies to help contribute in this area?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, SIP is a conservation reduction. I mean, so it's reducing. And that's been talked about, but there's a lot of complications with it. And I'm not the expert on SIP, but there is a lot of issues with trying to put this into a SIP program. And there's potential that maybe the Department of Commerce may want to address that a little bit to help answer your question.
Does the Department of Commerce want to address that?
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. Forgive me, Senator, we were having sort of an offline conversation, so I missed the question.
Mr. Chair, Peter, the question is, has there been any discussion of allowing this as maybe what part of what the companies could count as their SIP requirement for being innovative and providing more efficient options? I understand SIP is, in the general sense, you know, take a 60% efficient furnace and turn it into a 95% efficient furnace. That reduces the use, but it also advances the technology and the overall use. Has there ever been any discussion of using SIP dollars or credits from the company so they would be incented to kind of put this out there so we have maybe cleaner burning vehicles, more efficient gas? I understand they probably get higher miles per gallon, and so in some ways it fits into the conservation improvement program, which is ultimately a better use of our resources.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you for repeating the question. No, we have not had that discussion with CenterPoint or any other utilities. There is a similar proposal, which we'll hear in a few moments, on electric vehicle conversion. We've not had, to my knowledge, conversations with the electric utilities either on that, on using the SIP program or giving credit towards SIP goals.
for these types of programs, to my knowledge, to date.
And last question, Mr. Chair. On the efficiency of vehicles, Mr. Williams, or do one of you, Senator Hoffman, do one of your witnesses know, what are we looking at, generally speaking, for more efficiency on a light-duty pickup or some of these vehicles compared to the typical gasoline or the diesel? I mean, are we looking at what you might normally think of as 15, 20 miles to gallon, going up to 30 or 40 miles per gallon? And I know we had a bill go through transportation to equalize the per-gallon tax rate on CNG. But are we looking at vehicles getting more miles per gallon by doing this, or is it really just another option to get the same 15, 20 miles per gallon, for example?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I'll answer quickly, and any details Troy Sanvey could answer, but overall, the mileage is going to be about the same. You may see 10% better, you may see a little less, but generally it's about the same.
Okay.
Senator Ingebrigts. Real quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just real quickly about the conversion of propane versus natural gas. Can you talk to me real quickly about that? The propane's been around for a long time. What are the conversion differences there? And maybe we can also ask about the emissions, propane versus natural gas.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I really can't answer on the propane side as far as the converting, because I'm not an expert there, so I really wouldn't want to respond to that. You'd have to have somebody else answer to that. But as far as the emissions, the natural gas is the cleanest fossil fuel. And there's one carbon atom, and there's four hydrogen atoms. The next one is in order is propane. They're at three carbon and eight hydrogen. And then gasoline steps up. I don't have that off the top of my head. And then diesel. That's the order that I'm aware of, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, I thank you very much for hearing Senate File 1516. I would ask that somebody move this to be laid over for possible inclusion.
We'll lay this over, Senator Hoffman, for possible inclusion as amended. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Have a great day.
Senator Hurt, where do you go? Senator Marty, next for you. Senator Anderson here?
A couple of times this week, yeah. And I just wanted to podcast on in general.
No.
Okay, so you're not.
Yeah. See, no, here he is. Okay. Senator Hurt, you are up.
Why do you know that?
Senate File 1987.
I just couldn't think of it. I didn't see it. That's right.
Yeah, and rules. Finally, both boys voted it out.
Just speak that out. What's hands around here? We don't realize what's hands around.
Senator Hurst, Senate File 1987.
1987.
I missed a couple days last week, too, actually. So.
See, Mr. Chair, I have an author amendment to get this bill in shape.
This is coming around, and it's an author's amendment, and this is the first committee. So Senator Hur moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Senator Hur, go ahead on the A1 amendment.
Yeah, this based on feedback from stakeholders, we're expanding the language to allow protection and treatment of tree as acceptable use of the fund, and making this an ongoing appropriation instead of one time. Surveys show that we have seen MOS spores spread quickly this year, popping up in both Anoka and Dakota counties. So this will justify the needs of ongoing appropriation. And to the bill, Minnesota has, we did move the amendment. To the bill, Minnesota has the highest number of ash tree in the nation, over 900 million, mostly in northern regions. Any infestation that would wipe out the predominantly black ash swamp forests will have a catastrophic environmental and economic impact. Outlying city, towns, and counties have heavily planted ash tree along their street and shelter belts. The cost of treating and replacing ash trees is a significant burden for our local government to bear. It's important that the state provide resource, as they have done in the past, to local governments so that they can help slow the spread of annual ash borer and help manage the devastating effect of an infestation. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota City to talk more about why this funding is so important.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Very much appreciate the committee taking the time to discuss this briefly, and Senator Hurd for bringing the bill forward. So we currently in Minnesota have five counties already with standing quarantines due to emerald ash borer infestations. That's all of Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Olmsted, Winona, and Houston counties. We now have emergency quarantines that have been added in Dakota County and Anoka County because emerald ash borer has been found there. And we know how this pest progresses. It spreads slowly from any infected tree. By the time we find it, it usually has already spread because it takes time for it to show up at a level that can be detected. So what this means for our communities is you suddenly have an issue where you have to do a lot of investigation and a lot of management of public lands that you were not budgeting to do at that time. And so this funding becomes very important as a way to get a proper response that slows the spread of this disease while still making sure that we're doing it in the most responsible and cost-effective ways we can. This language is very similar to language that was used for a similar grant program that came out of the Lessard-Sams funds in their first set of funding that they did, in the first year of funding for that program. It's available to any city, county, or park district in a city of the first class. And it allows them to actually move forward with what the various steps they need to do, whether that's doing an inventory, whether it's doing treatment. They can choose which method of treatment works best. And it's a competitive grant program. So the submissions come in, and the state looks over which ones are getting the best bang for the buck and gets the monies out. This legislation does have a statewide effect. We know, for instance, that a lot of the cities that were hit hard by Dutch elm disease in the 70s unfortunately ended up putting a lot of green ash in to replace the elm trees that were taken out. And public land is heavily populated now with ash trees, especially boulevards and parks. And then, of course, once we get into northern Minnesota, black ash is a very dominant tree in the public lands and forests, and, of course, private lands and forests in northern Minnesota. So that's when you get to 900 million trees, that's how you get there, is Senator Saxog's district and Senator Tomasoni's districts. There's a lot of black ash up there. Thing I would note, Mr. Chair, is that we have had some discussions with the agencies. When an invasive pest is discovered, Department of Agriculture is the response agency that deals with an emergency response to a new infestation. Because of how settled in this is starting to become, especially in the metro area and the other quarantined counties, there's been a discussion that it might be more appropriate for this to go through DNR, which has the ongoing responsibility for forest management. We're more than happy to work with the author and the chair and the agencies to determine which agency is the best host for the program, but I don't think there's been any question that there's a very urgent need for these funds as communities are struggling to prevent trees from dying and falling in their jurisdictions. Last thing I would say, Mr. Chair, is just that this bill does include some prioritization, and that's going to be important. In the 70s for Dutch elm, we had a peak annual appropriation of $28 million a year going to dealing with Dutch elm in this state in 1978 dollars. So you can know that $5 million a year here is not going to be enough to handle a statewide plan and response to Dutch elm or to emerald ash borer. So we do need to make sure that there's some priorities on how the money goes out to make sure that we can get an adequate amount of work done where it's needed. happy to stand for any questions.
And I think the key here is publicly owned, and so I know in 2010 we did this through bonding money, so that's, I would think that's still a possibility for this bill this year, because as I've mentioned earlier, we have about $900 million in requests in this committee, and I have about a $51 million target, so it's going to be very difficult to meet some big numbers like this through my general fund, so we'll see how this goes in the next few days here. Senator Dietzick.
I think I might have just answered my own question, but I mean, you were talking, so thank you, Mr. Chair, but we're talking Emerald Ash Borer, which I know is a big issue, but if you go up on like line 1.8, you're talking about, starting on 1.7, shade trees damaged by or lost to forest pests or disease protection, and so you are, I mean, it kind of is, it's more than Emerald Ash Borer, but the priority is on Emerald Ash Borer, so I'm just clarifying that because that was my question.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you're exactly correct. It is beyond Emerald Ash Borer. The focus, obviously, because of the priority given in Ash Borer quarantined counties, is on Ash Borer, but there are other issues, gypsy moth, oak wilt. There's other places where you might have a response you need to be doing. And, you know, hopefully we won't have any new ones getting here right away, but there are some on their way that we know are going to require a pretty significant response when they get here, too.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Herr, would you be adverse to putting in an amendment in here to say that that an individual city cannot capture more than a certain dollar figure? I'm very concerned that this could wind up going to one city, let's say St. Paul or Minneapolis. That is not something where, is it, I'm sorry, did I see?
1.5 million.
Up to.
Line 1.5.
Is it 1.5? Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Senator Westrom.
Take it back.
Mr. Chair, on that, in that same vein, I was reading up to $1 million to a city of a first class. What's a city of first class? Senator?
I swear I didn't.
Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
I
you want to answer that?
I can answer that.
Go ahead.
City of first class would be large city like St. Paul, Minneapolis, and you know, Duluth or Rochester, large size city. I don't know the exactly population number, but it's not Marshall or some smaller city.
Craig, go ahead.
And, Mr. Chair, to be clear, this is the same language that was used in the previous grant program. So the grant can go to a city, any city, any county, or a park and recreation board of a city of the first class. So it's worded that way because, for instance, in Minneapolis, the parks are run by a park and recreation board, not by the city itself. So that extra phrase about cities of the first class is to reflect the park and rec boards of Minneapolis and St. Paul in particular.
So, but Mr. Chair, maybe staff would have, do we know what the population threshold is for a city of first class? Is it 50,000, 200,000, or could we look that up?
It's 100,000, but Duluth is grandfathered in.
Yes.
So maybe staff knows, how many towns do we have in the state that would be in that category?
Five?
We're only talking $5 million for Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth. What are the other three towns? Two towns.
Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester. Correct.
Mr. Chair, St. Cloud is not a city of the first class at this point.
Four. We only have four.
It's Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Duluth. But the only way that this applies to them is that this would only apply if the city has a park and rec board that manages its public lands. So in Minneapolis and St. Paul, they have that. That's why that phrase is added in here, because it would not be the city asking for the grant. It would be the Park and Rec Board asking for the grant. So I think to answer what I believe the senator's question is all cities are eligible for a grant of up to $1 million under this bill. It's just we needed that additional phrase of or park and rec boards in cities of the first class to reflect that those cities are run by a park and rec board, not by the city.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, thanks for the clarification. all cities or counties would be eligible. I was reading it the other way, that those were the only cities. You're saying if the city wanted the Park and Rec Board to make the application, only in those cities could the Park and Rec Board make the application?
Correct.
Senator Herr, I don't see any matching language with the city having to put something up, 50% or something. I'm wondering if you would be amenable to that idea, or is there any sort of match that you intend from this? Because with $5 million, the alternative is for the city to have to pay for it all themselves. I'm wondering if a match of 50% or something would be a way to help make this program more viable and make sure everybody's got a little skin in the game.
Senator?
Senator Westrom, I would see that that might be a little difficult to get a match because there's number of city and each city might want to take care of it differently. But you know, if you think about $5 million, you know, that's, and we're up against an invasive species that destroy our tree. That's not a lot, and also this money will guarantee for future prevention of the other invasive species as well.
And last question, Mr. Chair. Senator Herr, $1 million is a big amount, and if five cities come in asking for $1 million, it's wiped out. There's only probably 800,000-900,000 cities left in the state that didn't get any money. It seems to me maybe to spread this money out a little more, we should at least lower that cap to 250 or 500,000. And I understand the bigger cities are going to have bigger grant requests. My city of Elba Lake, I know, has talked about adding in some diversity to prevent from an ash tree disease wiping out several of the boulevards. And so they're thinking ahead. But to improve this bill, I think we should lower that cap, add a match in, and maybe you have two thresholds for cities under a certain size versus larger cities, but I think $1 million gets to be pretty generous in the ability for just a few applications to wipe out the whole account, yeah, knowing how we need to stretch these dollars. Those would be my comments and thoughts if you're open to some or all of them.
Thank you, Senator Westrom. I appreciate your comment, and I would welcome maybe we had to have further discussion, you know, and I don't have all the information right now for me to decide, so we'll have further discussion as the bill's role lay over for inclusion.
Thank you.
Senator Dietzler.
I had a question on, I know it's about $2,500, I believe, to remove a tree. Do you have the, is that about right? And then do you know how much it is to plant it? Because, I mean, the costs do add quickly, so I think $250,000 for at least my city would go pretty quickly. I know they have put in, I mean, they replaced, and I don't know, I mean, on their own, I think they replaced about 2,500 trees over the last few years just based on they lost 25 to 3,500 from Theater Worth all the way to Worth Park during the tornado, and a lot of that was just on their own, and I know they've spent a lot of initiative to replace in my neighborhood where whole streets have been wiped out by Emerald Ash Borer, where they've done that on their own, and so I understand where Senator Herr is coming from, where some cities might not be able to provide a match, but I know my city is doing that anyway, and so, again, you might tier it. And, again, to just make it last more, so my first question was about $2,500. I was just curious on how much it is to replace a tree and dig the tree out, take it down, dig the stump out, and replace it. And then I agree with Senator Westrom, if we need to tier it to just make it spread out some more, I would rather go to the tiers, if possible.
Okay, we have lots of possibilities here then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do your other testifiers feel like they need to testify, or
One question of Mr. Johnson.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, talk to us a little bit about legacy funding. None of that has been used for any of this. I know you talked the earlier $2 million, I think it was, from Lesage Sams. How about parks and trails funding? Has any dollars been expended from there? I don't know that.
Mr. Chair and members, no. The only funding that has come from legacy funds for this is in the initial fund, the first 2 years of legacy funding, there was $2 million that came from Lazard Sams, and it happened literally because St. Paul found Emerald Ash Borer in the city during conference committee, basically, and there was a reaction to get some funding out to deal with it. Since then, there was also a bonding allocation that was made, as the chair pointed out, in 2010. That actually took a couple of years to get out the door because of the wording and some concern about what if trees counted as public infrastructure or not. We pointed out that a tree is kind of designed to last 100 years or so, and buildings are usually designed to last 50, so they probably are designed to last about the same amount of time. And it ended up being able to go out the door, but it took a couple of years with Minnesota management and budget before we were able to get those grants out the door. But that's the extent of funding that's gone to this so far. And, Mr. Chair, I would just add that cities are dealing with emerald ash borer in preparation for it right now all over the state, and they're doing it on their own dime. The reason we're here looking for this additional bump is because when it is found, that cost goes up very, very quickly, and a community can really get caught in a situation where they can't afford to keep up with the problem that they've found they're in. Thank you.
Okay. Senator, you have three other testifiers. Do they all want to testify, or are we... They're all three going to testify.
Mr. Johnson, want to have a few words.
Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just in response to that last question, one of the other challenges with park and trail funding, as I was just handed a note, is that it's limited to statewide and regional significant facilities. So to access park and trail funds, it would only be available in if you were doing work in something that had already been identified to meet that constitutional threshold.
Welcome to the committee. Who wants to go first? Just say your name for the record.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Keep from repeating each other. That'd be great.
Yes, of course. My name is Karen Zumach. I am the manager of community forestry for Tree Trust. I'm the vice president of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, which is the Minnesota Urban Forestry Council, the organization that is required to receive funding from the Forest Service for state community forestry programming. I'm here to talk briefly about a group of people that we assembled back in January of 2015 to talk about emerald ash borer and a regional response on behalf of private industry and members of the DNR, most specifically the invasive species coordinator. We met to talk about a plan for emerald ash borer on a statewide level, and from that, with members from the Forest Service, several state agencies, University of Minnesota, private industry, including the MNLA, and nonprofit organizations, we came up with a plan that included a science team, which was there to research the science behind a regional response to emerald ash borer, our outreach team, which has been working diligently to get the word out about a regional program, and a proposal team, which worked to put to work language together for a proposal. You'll find within your packets that were distributed a brief summary of our testimony today, as well as the document that was created by our science team that includes six PhDs, stating that a regional response to emerald ash borer, including preservation, is the most cost-effective way to manage this bug. We in Minnesota here are in the best situation to do things differently than the way they've been done, where it's been decimating communities. Funding is required on a regional scale to help not only those large cities that are dealing with big infestations, but those smaller communities all around the state that have large populations of ash trees. No community will be able to do this without assistance. It's corner to corner within this state, and talking about issues of air quality, environmental benefits, all of those things will be lost when those trees are removed. Managing these trees through treatment and preservation will preserve the canopy and the environmental benefits associated with that, and we hope that you can support Senate File 1987.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Michael Orange. I've been a city planner for 30 years. I've been working with cities, and for the last 8 years, I have my own company called Orange Environmental. And working with cities and doing studies for cities, I have concluded three things regarding the emerald ash borer infestation. Number one is that you don't fight a human health epidemic city by city. And in the same way, we can't fight an EAB infestation city by city. As Ms. Zumach pointed out, we know from science that an area-wide, a statewide approach is what's necessary. It's the most economical, the most effective, the most environmentally sound way to do it. That's why we're in support of this bill. Secondly, we know from cities that this can devastate their budgets. In fact, when we looked at analysis that looking at about 15 cities around the region, that it can cost an average city about $1 million to fight this infestation. That's a lot of money. And finally, there's a better way. When cities back east were hit with this infestation, they didn't really know what hit them. They didn't know what to do. But we've had 14 years of scientific research since then and know that there is a better way. Scientists conclude that as a part of managing this infestation, we need to protect trees as well. And in fact, if you look at it from an economic standpoint, over a 20-year period, every dollar invested in protecting a high-quality ash tree preserves four times the tree value, four times the economic value of that tree, the environmental value of that tree, and protection can cost half of what it would take to simply remove and replace that tree. So in sum, we need this statewide community protection bill with protection involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Hafner. I'm with Rainbow Tree Care. I'm a municipal consultant. I partner with cities all across the country to manage urban forest concerns, largely Emerald Ash Borer. And I know that the cities here in Minnesota greatly need the state's help. They are under-budgeted, understaffed, and they are about to have to deal with some of the highest costs their urban forestry budgets have ever seen. My work across the country makes me very aware of the devastation that EAB has caused in other communities that didn't work in a unified regional approach and did not include protection as part of the strategy. We have an option here in Minnesota to do things differently. As my colleagues have said, we protect trees not only for the reduced costs, the increased benefits, but also from a pure pest management standpoint. Tree protection absolutely needs to be a tool that cities are allowed to use in order to manage this infestation. The partnership that Ms. Zumach alluded to or spoke of earlier is in support of SF 1987 with the addition of protection, and I'm supportive as well. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions from anybody? Okay. Okay, Senator Hurd, then we'll lay over Senate File 1987 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Marty in the room?
To the testifiers, absolutely.
Well, there you are, right behind him. Senator Marty, Senate File 1948. And we've got three bills to do if we can get them done in the next half hour.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I actually have a delete everything amendment that I believe may be in the packets. This is not the first committee, so I think we should go through it. It's not an author's amendment in that sense. And actually had one oral amendment to that. This amendment reflects changes that were discussed, raised concerns by members of the Environment and Energy Committee, as well as some discussions between the coalition and some of the utilities involved to address concerns. And, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I could give you, or have Senate Council give you the oral amendment that I'd like to incorporate.
Let's have the oral amendment so we can incorporate it into the A3.
Mr. Chair, members, the oral amendment would be on page 3, line 3.10. After eligibility, delete everything after eligibility and insert to maximize the effectiveness in promoting use of electric vehicles. So this paragraph C would just allow the commissioner to reduce the rebate amounts that are allowed under the bill or restrict program eligibility in order to maximize the effectiveness in promoting use of electric vehicles.
And so, Mr. Chair, perhaps we just go through the bill and have the testimony, and then you can, for your consideration, the omnibus bill, if so, adopt the delete everything. I don't know when you'd like to do that, but...
Why don't you go through the A3 amendment?
Sure, and the first section of the bill is simply, the definitions of the program what electric vehicle is. We've changed one thing in the past. It wasn't entirely clear whether a hybrid automobile would count as this. We're making it clear it has to be a plug-in hybrid that runs simply on electric for part of the time, and a separate rebate level for that, which is lower than for an all-electric vehicle. The section 2 is simply that the utilities, in this case Minnesota Power and Xcel, would be operating a program to promote the use of electric vehicles, and would involve education materials, and could involve both of these. Could involve rebates for installing vehicle charging stations at residences or workplaces. That'd be up to them. The Department of Commerce would review the plan submitted. They could modify, reject, whatever, and then the utilities would be coming back with a new plan. Cost recovery in Subdivision 4 is simply that they could recover expenses for the public advertisement or other promotion program things. They'd have to report annually to the Commissioner of Commerce on the effectiveness of the program. Section 2 of the bill is an electric vehicle rebate and incentive program. As you can see in Subdivision 2, you'd be purchasing an electric vehicle, a new one, and it would be limited to one per household or one per business in a year. The rebate amounts would initially be $250 for a fully electric vehicle and $1,500 for a plug-in hybrid. And as you can see on page 3 of the bill...
$2,500, you mean?
$2,500. Did I say 25?
You said 250.
250.
Okay, all right.
Okay, sorry about that.
No problem.
The limit on number of rebates would be, as it says on the next page, one per resident household and one rebate per business entity per year. The commissioner would, Commerce would administer the program, and this would sunset 5 years from now, and we're asking, we would be hoping, of course, it's whatever the committee could do. If so, we'd be hoping for $2.5 million per year for the biennium to promote this. And real briefly, the point of promoting electric vehicles, as the testimony will say, is because it's one, it's environmentally better, and with the chamber and others very concerned about the clean air standards in the metro area, this will significantly help to do that. Number two, I think that these are the direction the future is going to be going. If you have a sheet in your handout, that talks about the mile per gallon equivalent. Some of these cars, they're talking 100 mile per gallon equivalent. They're very efficient. They're cleaner cars, and Minnesota, the witnesses can tell you, it's not been going very well now because a lot of dealers aren't getting the cars they need to sell. And we have Amber Bacchus from the auto dealers here. And
Senator Marty, do you want to insert $2.5 million in those blank spaces?
Yes. It's up to the committee. If you're going to be figuring out if you're able to put this in.
I mean, just for purposes of the committee.
For purposes of discussion.
So that's, you want to incorporate that. You want to incorporate that in the amendment.
Please.
And I think for the committee, purposes of the committee, let's get the amendment in front of us. Senator Dibble, you move the A3 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Adopted. Okay, go ahead with
your... have our witnesses. Start with Amber from Auto Dealers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Bacchus with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, and I'm here representing the Drive Electric Coalition. Drive Electric is the state's plug-in electric vehicle coalition, and besides auto dealers, it includes automakers, electric utilities, local governments, the environmental community, and most importantly, consumers. Our coalition believes electric vehicles are an important component of an energy-efficient and cleaner transportation system in Minnesota that is both financially and environmentally sustainable. Advancing electric vehicle deployment will have many benefits to Minnesotans, including reduced transportation costs, cleaner air, and energy independence. A few examples of the benefits to air quality in the environment include the fact that electric vehicles are 3 to 4 times more efficient than gas-powered vehicles, They have zero emissions from the tailpipe and thus can play a role in lowering every type of pollutant associated with vehicles, including greenhouse gases, nitrogen oxide, volatile organic compounds, and particulates. And electric vehicles can directly use renewable wind or solar electricity. Drive Electric Minnesota's Policy Committee has made two recommendations on the most important steps the state could take to help consumers realize the benefits of plug-in electric vehicles. Both of these are reflected in the Delete All Amendments to Senate File 1948 that are before you for consideration. First, we should follow the lead of many other states in creating a rebate program to accelerate sales. And second, we should enable and encourage investment by utilities so that utility ratepayers can share in the benefits that electric vehicles offer to the electricity system. Plug-in electric vehicles are still an emerging market, as they comprise only 0.02% of the vehicles registered in Minnesota in 2012. The two primary barriers to ownership are range and price, with electric vehicles costing on average $10,000 to $15,000 more than the comparable conventional vehicle. States that have provided incentives to purchase cleaner electric vehicles, like what's included in the bill before you, have seen sales of 2 to 4 times the national average. And again, why would we want to incent the purchase of electric vehicles and encourage the development of that infrastructure? As you already heard from Senator Marty and the testifiers on the natural gas bill, emissions from mobile sources have dropped significantly over the past 10 years, but gas and diesel vehicles are still the biggest source of pollutants that contribute to ground-level ozone. Encouraging Minnesotans to drive zero-emission electric vehicles will further curb pollutants to keep Minnesota from becoming a non-attainment area, a consequence that would cost consumers and businesses hundreds of millions of dollars more than the incentives provided in this bill. For example, a reformulated gasoline that is required in non-attainment areas typically costs 15 to 20 cents more a gallon than conventional gasoline. We believe the time is right for establishing a plug-in electric vehicle rebate program. Minnesota has a budget surplus that should be used as a short-term investment that can produce long-term environmental and economic gains. Thank you to Senator Marty for bringing the bill forward and for working with Drive Electric to get language we can collectively support. We hope the committee will do the same, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
This witness, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who said that electric vehicles are not available. Why is that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it is an emerging market in Minnesota, and last year we did see a 10% decrease in sales. When those sales go down, the manufacturers are less likely to provide more of those vehicles to the state because they don't see the market here. So with the incentive program, we could hopefully boost that up and eventually have be realizing the economies of scale that will bring the price down and get them here more frequently.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you also said zero emissions from the tailpipe. That's pretty obvious, I think, to common folk out there. But the question that I always get from people about electric cars is that power has to come from someplace. Now, of course, there's wind energy, there's solar, but it comes from coal-burning plants, generally, at least in Minnesota, and maybe some others. So how do I convince the public that I'm spending these dollars wisely when the burning of coal is actually increasing, and obviously that's not good for our atmosphere. So give me the little better idea as to how I answer that.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, first of all, yes, if you look at the efficiency factor on the chart I think you have, you can see that it is the efficiency part of it helps an incredible amount. Number two, we are having, I think coal is now 40% about of our grid. It's declining, and again, many of the, I think Dakota Electric has, and I think the investor-owned utilities are developing time-of-day rates where people charge the vehicles late at night when sometimes heavy wind power. In other words, utilities can use this to help balance the grid. And in terms of it, I think all the studies have looked at, whether it's greenhouse gases or whatever, that this is a net impact, a positive impact. And again, as coal use is declining in the state, it's seen as a big plus. So again, Ms. Backus was talking about the the impact in the air quality in the area, in the metro area, in effect. This helps. Yes, there is some of the power generating these is coming from coal plants. It's a declining portion of that, and I think it's going to continue to decline fairly significantly in the next decade.
So,
yeah, real quickly, to the testifier, Ms. Backus, then, so the utility trucks you talk about, the heavy ones that out that have to respond to all our utility needs that are generally either very high horsepower gas or diesel engines, are there electric vehicles on the horizon, or are they already being produced now that can actually handle that type of a load? Not only do they park and have to get there with heavy equipment, but they also have to generate lots of power on site.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbretson, we are not seeing electric vehicles so much in the heavy-duty vehicle market because they don't have the power needed. There are some smaller packaging companies and things that are using that in their trucks, but with the heavy-duty vehicles, we are seeing more of the natural gas that you discussed in the earlier bill before the committee.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to respond to Senator Ingebrigtsen's previous question, and anyone at the table can correct me if I'm wrong, but I recall learning at some point along the way that coal plants never do power down. They run through the night. You can't really turn them off. And so this is an opportunity. There is no increased use of coal necessarily. I think they slow down a little bit, but they don't power down. So there's no real increased use of coal necessarily, but utilizing electrical generation that's occurring at night when the cars are charging. So taking advantage of existing baseload from these coal plants, all the more so incented with these time of day rates. Is that correct? That's what I recall. I don't know if that's still true.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dribble, yes, that's basically correct. One other comment on Senator Ingebrigtsen's point about the heavier vehicles. I've actually rode on an all-electric, full city-sized bus in Washington State, which they said the cost of the electricity and their costs are cheaper because they have large amounts of hydro there. But their cost was about $6 for fueling the vehicle for a day. They need one fill-up of the day, which is huge batteries. I mean, an all-electric bus. They said typically it was using like 85 gallons of diesel fuel in a day for a regular thing. It's expensive. It was like an extra $300,000 more of a $500,000 bus. But bottom line is, I think that what we're looking at is we think electric vehicles are far more likely to be in the passenger vehicle size, not in the heavy-duty vehicles.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, I'm finding the rebate part of this a little bit problematic in this respect. In Senator Dibble's committee, we've heard a bill to do mileage-based user fees and other fees based on the fact that electric cars don't pay gas taxes. So here we are incentivizing people through the general fund to buy an electric car. We can debate whether that's good or bad. But then in Senator Dibble's committee, we're taking the money back through other means. And I'm just sort of I'm curious on your take on that, in that why should we give and take as opposed to just letting this, you know, be dealt with at the consumer level? Because, you know, we're trying to deal with a budget, but it doesn't make sense to me at all that we would do a rebate program so that we could incentivize taxing them later. So,
Backus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, there is, as I said, that differential on the cost of an electric vehicle and the comparable conventional vehicle, and people are paying more to do the right thing right now. And with that big difference, we see that folks are paying more in the motor vehicle sales tax collected and the registration fees collected, and that difference equals about 7.5 years of fuel tax that would be paid on the conventional vehicle. So we think while that difference exists, we think electric vehicles are paying their fair share. As you get more on the road, hopefully the price will come down, that difference will go away, and then I think you have that discussion. But as it's an emergent market and you are making up for the lost revenue through MVEST and the registration fees, we'd hate to have an additional fee on on the vehicles right now to disincent their purchase.
Okay, let's go to our other witness.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jukka Kukkonen from Plug-in Connect, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Electric Vehicle Owners as the coordinator of Minnesota Plug-in Vehicle Owners Circle. And I'm an automotive engineer, so I often approach things from technical standpoint, and that's why I want to talk a little bit more about this this economy of new vehicles sold graph. If you look at that graph, the lowest graph line there is the blue line, which is the internal combustion engines. So our traditional vehicles and their economy over the years from 75 to 2013. So we have gone from a little less than 20 miles per gallon to about 25 miles per gallon over that time. And if you think about all the new technologies that have been brought into that area, like lighter materials, fuel injection, turbocharging, variable camshaft timing, and all of that stuff, and our improvement has been very, very, very modest when looking at this one. We actually saw much bigger improvement in this area in 2002 when the hybrid technology was brought in the market, which is the green line there. We are talking about over 40 miles per gallon average numbers there. But then you look at the electric vehicles, and we're now talking about over 100 miles per gallon. So it's a totally different ballpark in that way. And this efficiency is what makes difference to us in so many different levels in there. So when a person shifts to driving electric, they overnight stop using oil. They stop producing local emissions during their drive. And their driving costs drop to 75%. Their money stops flowing to the big oil companies outside of Minnesota. But instead, first of all, they save the 75%. And then the last 25% goes into local utility companies, which is much better deal, if you ask me. And on top of that, they just have much more fun driving, too. You can ask this from any electric vehicle owner. They just love their cars. There was a study done where they asked 3,300 electric vehicle owners, will your next car be electric, too? And 97% of those people said yes. So in many cases, it's just that people are a little hesitant to move into new technology, but when they get to experience it and realize the advantages, they just love it. So how can we help people make this shift? Minnesota Plug-in Vehicle Owners, like me, work every day to provide real-life information to people about this, but that work, of course, is not adequate. As I said, people tend to resist the change, so we need all the resources available to speed up the adoption. Based on my calculations, some of the major car manufacturers will lose the federal tax incentives in less than 3 years. So now is a really time to act to take advantage of this time frame. We need to get people to test drive and experience these vehicles right now, because faster we get Minnesotans driving electric, faster this shift will happen, and that means big positive impact to Minnesota's economy. And this change will benefit everyone. Thank you.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Real quickly, and I don't want to belabor anything here, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator Marty, you mentioned when you were out in Washington, D.C., and you mentioned hydropower. My question is, and I'm trying to go from my memory here, is hydropower now in Minnesota allowed? There's some hydropower coming in. Are they energy companies, are you able to use that as part of their alternative energy credits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we're discussing how to deal with future hydro. What we're not looking at doing is taking existing hydro and just starting to count a different equation. But I think the thing is, in with hydropower, which is anything new, seems to be coming. There's a tiny project in Iowa, but anything big seems to be coming from Manitoba, and those are huge chunks. They're not going to come a little bit at a time, and I think that's one thing we're looking at for how we deal with the future of renewable energy. But I think the bottom line is, if you look at what the utilities are projecting for where they're getting their power, they would say that coal is going down. It's definitely going down, and you're going to be seeing a lot more renewables of all kinds, including, I believe, big hydro.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. So the answer is no, and I'll talk to you about that later. That's fine. Thanks.
Okay, then Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I really would appreciate if the committee can find a way to put this in. I think, as you just heard, the federal rebates go for a certain number of car sales, and then they lose the rebates on those cars. In effect, some states that are well ahead of Minnesota in electric car adoption, it's their constituents are getting electric vehicle rebates. We'd like to have more of that coming to Minnesota. I think the auto dealers and auto consumers and all of us would benefit from this, so I urge your consideration.
Okay. And we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you, Senator Martin.
Thank you all very much.
Senator Anderson. You know what? Maybe that's a good idea. How long was yours going to be?
Couldn't be.
Can we do it in 7 minutes? 2 minutes? Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, if you don't want me to talk, I'll just let my testifier talk. Then I'll be less than 2 minutes.
Go right ahead. Senate File 1965.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 1965 is exciting and new innovative project being advanced by a company in my district, Randy Sanitation and Organic Solutions. Randy's is planning to build a state-of-the-art solid waste processing facility and anaerobic digester operational by 2017. This project will be the first of its kind in Minnesota and a leader nationally in how we process waste and use the outputs for a higher and better purpose. This project incorporates many of the issues this committee cares about. The digester project has strong environmental components. It will divert solid waste currently landfilled and incinerated to create a renewable natural gas, which will be used to power Randy's environmental service fleet of trucks. The project will be an essential component of the state of Minnesota reaching its recycling goal of 75% by 2030. The project also has an economic development benefit. The project will create 60 to 80 short-term construction jobs and 25 good long-term paying jobs in the community. The technology is innovative and state-of-the-art of Minnesota, and Minnesota has an opportunity to be a national leader. This project will have agricultural applications as well, as another one of the outputs is a high-quality compost that can be used by the ag industry in fields. Additionally, a byproduct will be CO2, which has applications in the greenhouse operations, and this bill is asking for a request of $2.85 million to help advance a state-of-the-art pioneer project in the field of waste management. The total project cost is in excess of $30 million, with the company owners financing the remainder of the project. This is a good return on investment of over 10-to-1 investment. And today with me, I have Jim Walschlager from CEO of the Organic Solutions, which is a subdivision of Randy's, and I let him have the opportunity to speak.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Committee Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Walschlager, CEO of Organic Solutions. Organic Solutions is a subsidiary of Randy Solutions. This project that we have before you today is 10 years in the making. To get to the point we are right here, we've been involved in this project for 10 years to find and be able to bring forward a sustainable option that not only can digest a portion of the MSW stream to create natural gas for the trucks, but to take it to that next level and be able to get at a section of the waste stream, the soil paper products, that right now, short of this process and our facility, your opportunity to get that material out of the waste stream is by hand picking it off a sort line. So when the material comes into this building and runs through the burst cell process, which is the innovative pioneering part of this component, that vacuum assisted vessel in a batch process will sort the organic waste from the non-organic waste in the waste stream. The organic waste will go off and be either put in the composter or the digester to be turned into natural gas for our fleet of trucks. The remainder of that material will go off and be composted, cleaned up, and be able to use as an agricultural byproduct. So this project meets the 75% recycling goal by 2030. This project meets the state's 65% processing goal. And by investing in this project now and understanding this is always a tough thing to do and a tough thing to ask for, the PCA now has the opportunity for oversight on this project, to look and provide insight in this project, because the goal of this, if Organic Solutions builds a digester in Delano and that's how this ends, I would be very disappointed that that was the outcome of this project. I believe this is the future of waste handling. When I can sit here and tell you that we're going to remove 75% from the waste stream to a higher and better use, and we're going to do it the day we turn the switch on this project, that's an amazing statement to make. Hennepin County is following this process closely. Ramsey, Washington County have project. They're following this project closely. And obviously the PCA is involved in following this project. So the first people in, the people that have to carry the heavy load, and obviously right now that's us. The burst cell process in this project and the equipment process in this project will run about $14 million. 3 years from now, when the second or third or fourth one is built, it'll be two-thirds of that, because efficiencies of manufacturing and the efficiencies of standardization will have taken place. Changes will have been made, and the price will come down. So while the price and early adopters have to pay it, we're asking for the state to partner with us on this, to not only get this project done, but to look downstream to find a way to get more of these projects done, because this is how we're going to meet your goals.
Okay. Any comments or questions?
Senator Ingersoll. Real quickly, Mr. Chair, does this include construction materials? No?
Yes, it does.
Good. Yeah, yep. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. Seeing none, then Senator Anderson will lead us over for possible inclusion. Members, we've got one more bill up for today, but we've got to get out of here.
Thank you.
Chair. So there's a Senate File 1998 in your packet. Would you please put that in your folder? What we're going to do is with your agenda, and we're going to break for 15 minutes and go across the hall and finish Senator Herr's bill. And that way the people that came here to testify don't have to come back tomorrow. And so we'll get that one done. So if you just put Senate File 1998 in your folder, and the staff will get it across the hall and bring it along with your agenda. Rest of the stuff you can leave on the table. And then we will reconvene at 2:15 over in room 112. And so for now, the committee is in recess.
We want to do a rebate program, and then we're going to create new and inventive ways to tax.
Sacks on workouts.
Hey, that's what we do around here.
Nobody sees the problem with putting the rebate on something, then we're going to slap
them
with
the SOB. Room 500.
We're going to and just reconvene at 2:15.